Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The man who co-founded Twitter with its limitation of 140 characters per tweet is hardly against expanded conversation. In fact, he's currently on a campaign to encourage more dialogue between communities and their businesses. Jack Dorsey is also co-founder of Square, Inc., a mobile credit card payment company. Under Square's banner, he's kicking off a national on-the-road campaign called Let's Talk. It begins right here in St. Louis this evening. St. Louis, of course, is his hometown. The idea of it all is to strengthen communities by encouraging entrepreneurship. Dorsey believes that when businesses are successful, they grow and the community prospers. Jack Dorsey joins me in studio. And also with us are two local business owners who will participate in that Let's Talk event this evening at Kesseloma Ballroom. Katie Miller is the owner of Scarlet Garnet Jewelry. Scott Carey is the owner of Sump Coffee here. And a little bit later, we'll be joined by Dennis Melton, District Director of the Small Business Administration of Eastern Missouri. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to see you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jack, welcome home.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And congratulations, by the way, on all your success. I know St. Louisans are very proud of all that you've accomplished so far, with more to come, I'm sure. Let me begin with you, Jack. What is the genesis of this whole Let's Talk campaign?
Well, we started in San Francisco, where the company is based, and going neighborhood to neighborhood. And we believe fundamentally that we are building tools to encourage local businesses to thrive and to grow and to make it easier for them to get into commerce, make it easier for them to build their business and run their business. But some of those tools are not just software tools, they're not just hardware tools, but they're best practices. And we wanted to have a very simple conversation with local neighborhood retailers, local neighborhood coffee stores, independent sellers like piano teachers or golf instructors, about what works and what doesn't work, what challenges one has and folks and what they found to really propel them in a way that they wanted to share with other folks. So we started this Let's Talk venue, and we went to these neighborhoods, and we had four local merchants come on stage with us, and we just had questions. We asked what's working? What's challenging? What would you want to change? What do you want to learn the most about? And it was, you know, populated in the audience by folks who are also starting businesses or building businesses or had the same concerns. And I find no matter how big you are, whether you're a Twitter or a Facebook or an Instagram or a little cafe around the corner, you all care about the same things. You all see the same issues. Number one, it's just how do you get new customers? Number two is how do you retain those customers? How do you get those customers coming back? And one of the things I love the most about these conversations is it tends to draw a really local and crafted experience. People who are not just interested in the output of the work, but the work itself. And it really shows in a lot of these businesses and a lot of these sellers.
Are you learning that there's not as much of a connect, perhaps, as there should be between local businesses and the communities around them?
I think there is definitely a detachment. You know, when I was growing up, the neighborhood was so important to me. I could go, you know, to my neighbor's house, and I could receive mentorship and support and, you know, just hang out. I haven't seen the same for a lot of local businesses, and anything that we can do to help strengthen that again. And I think the merchants we've met, the sellers we've met, they're all interested in doing that. They're all interested in figuring out how to get the city and the government to support them more in building their business and finding those interfaces to do that. But it's just having the conversation, kicking it off. So this is a chance to get everyone together in one place to start that conversation. Hopefully it's something that is meaningful enough that people want to continue it.
Are you finding that these merchants are looking over their shoulders at the big box stores and the malls that surround our cities?
Well, I think there's a trend generally across this country seeking out more locally crafted experiences. There was a great New York Times article not too long ago that stated the number of coffee houses in New York City, independent coffee houses in New York City, is outnumbering the number of Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts combined. So there is a flight towards quality. There's a flight towards more local crafted experiences. And that's one of the things we love to support. And, you know, our whole mission is to make commerce easy, to make it easy for anyone, no matter what they love to do, no matter who they are, to pick up a tool they already have, which is their phone, plug in a little tiny device, and they can participate in where electronic commerce is moving, which is a plastic card and more online.
So maybe it's Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts that are looking over their shoulders, huh?
I think so.
All right. Let me turn to our two other guests here. And Scott, Carrie, I'll start with you because we just mentioned coffee shops, and that's basically the business you're in. But what's your take on all of this? How do you see what Jack is trying to do and how it relates to you?
Well, I think it's definitely positive. I see some of the trends that he's highlighted in terms of the flight to quality that he talked about. But instead of it offering a tool so that I can just take payment, it actually allows us to sort of underscore a philosophy we're trying to embrace within the shop. So most of the time when you go to a coffee shop, the first thing they do is they take your order. They may take your name, but they also take your money before you get anything at all. And depending on what you do with yourself, whether you stand in line or you stand there awkwardly, what I feel like Square has allowed us to do is essentially create a minimization of that happening, and we allow the customers to pay at the end. We take their orders. We ask them to take a seat. And because of that light footprint, that petite footprint, you can't even see where our point of sale is. It's not like we don't have order here, pay here. We're trying to create an experience where you come in and you experience the coffee much like you might experience a wine. So we want to talk to you and engage you about the coffee. I don't want you to see some big thing where really you're feeling like you just want to give me money right away and I want to take it. I want you to have an experience, and I want you to find it worth it and then sort of, you know, do the exchange. And I feel that Square, the way we have it set up and the way we have the shop set up, underlines that philosophy and reinforces what we're trying to do with the coffee.
Jack, let me just ask you, given the way he just presented his case, it sounds to me like the tour is really a promotional tour for Square.
Well, I mean, that was a beautiful explanation, first of all.
It's been recorded, by the way, if you were to use it.
But we want to make sure that we're not putting Square first. I think the company has done a great job at really highlighting our sellers and highlighting our merchants. Certainly, we want to be in the conversation about the tools that, you know, a lot of these sellers are using. But generally, there is a desire, and a lot of this focus came out of the reason we started this is we have an internal meeting every week called Town Square, which every Friday after the week is done, we talk about everything that we launched, everything that we worked on, everything that we did really well and everything that we screwed up, just a way to learn. And what if we were to export that idea to the world? What if we were to export it to neighborhoods around our office, to neighborhoods around San Francisco, to neighborhoods around the Bay Area? And then what if we expand that even broader to the United States? So we feel like we've learned a lot in building a company, and we do see a lot of common threads between all companies, no matter how big and how small they are. How do we share that? And if we get a new customer out of it, then great. But the venue and the conversation is great for us too, because we learn what people are facing. We learn what we might need to build into our product, what we might need to build into our service, or what we may need to make disappear completely, to Scott's point.
Okay. Katie, with regard to your operation, what about your connect with the community? How do you see all this working for you, what we've been talking about? Not necessarily with regard to Square, although I understand its importance, but in terms of the connect between you and the people, the potential customers around you.
Well, I know being able to talk to other business owners has really helped us troubleshoot different things that we have going on. And as far as finding potential customers, with what we're doing with Square, we're able to get out and be in multiple places at one time. We can be in a farmer's market or be in Seattle at a craft show, and really being able to have this seamless transaction happen for us in cities all over the place too.
What do you hope to take away from tonight's meeting?
Really hearing everybody's story is very inspirational. You know, and thinking about answers to questions, I've been doing research on a lot of different businesses and seeing how they've expanded and how they've grown and how they've taken some small little idea and really ran with it. And that it's been so exciting to hear all these stories, and it really gets you energized about what we're doing on the street and, you know, what all these businesses can grow to be.
Go ahead, Scott. Of course.
So, you know, I talked about how we use Square as a tool in the shop. But in terms of what they're doing in town tonight, I think that impact is something that will be seen, right? So that's not something that has really been provided up until now. But what tonight, the way I see tonight, when we opened the business, we bought the building. So we sort of fought a war on two fronts. We had to get our occupancy permit, but we also had to run a business. So I like the fact that this is a dialogue, and it's not just people that use Square that are going to come tonight, but it's going to be the alderman. It's going to be my alderman. It's going to be the mayor. It's going to be the mayor's assistant, which I've already sort of talked about some of my concerns. So I like that it's not just like I use Square in this novel, neat way, but it's like we are – building South City and basically to create regionalism, to create a reason to want to live in St. Louis. You don't want big box stores. Big box stores, you can have that experience anywhere and there's nothing wrong with it. But the reason why people attach to a city or a location is the regionalism. It's the neighborhoods. It doesn't have to be a coffee shop, but it's the things such as that don't go away, the institutions of St. Louis, like Ted Drews, say, you know, when people leave, like I was gone for 20 years, every time I came back, I had to go to Ted Drews. I don't mean to make it a commercial for them, but that's part of my culture growing up. So I think what's happening here, it's not up to this point, it's been a dongle on a device. But what they're doing now is building something beyond the dongle on the device. And that's what's really interesting about what's going to happen tonight.
Well, is it going to continue beyond tonight? I mean, dialogue should be ongoing, I suppose, to be productive and to maintain whatever momentum is generated tonight.
I would hope so, and that's why we picked South City. That's why we picked the area we're in, because I lived in Williamsburg, New York for a while before it really broke. And I feel like there's a very diluted kind of DIY entrepreneurship that's happening there. And so hopefully that this encourages people and continues that growth.
All right. Anything you want to add to that, Katie?
I think already there is a lot of communication between business owners. I'm already on a couple different Facebook forums where we're talking about, you know, what problems are you having? Who has a suggestion for a good accountant? Who knows about this area that just came up, like this storefront that just became available? So I think that it's already happening, but this is a great way to get people talking about it more. And also for the people who are pretty well established in the area, that we can be talking to people who are thinking about investing in the area or starting their own business and be, you know, a little bit of an inspiration to them too.
Jack, what is the role of social media in all of this? I mean, obviously it's, as you well know, I suspect, it's taken off, you know, just like a rocket. What's its role in what we're talking about?
Well, I think the role of any technology throughout our civilization is twofold. Number one, it's to increase the velocity. And number two, it's to increase the participation. So the more people can use a tool and they can use it faster. But all of this has to go back to communication. So to Scott and Katie's point, it's really around it's providing a great spotlight on a conversation that needs to continue to happen. So it's awesome to hear that, you know, sellers and local businesses are talking with each other. It's awesome to hear that there is a spotlight on the relationship and the thread between local businesses and a desire to live in a neighborhood, desire to build up a city. And I think that's very, very strong. I do believe fundamentally that if we build strong networks in the neighborhood, we will build a strong nation, and it will help us and our government and our nation and our economy. So if you focus on the small economy, you can actually have dramatic effect on the national economy and potentially the global economy as well. So these small steps really, really help us. And social media allows that to be seen on a global stage. You know, it enables folks who are using it to not just talk to the neighborhood, but anyone around the world can see the trials, the tribulations, the challenges, the wins, the successes, and learn from that and be inspired by it in order to do it in their own locale as well.
You know, it's remarkable the way it works around the world, thanks in large part to what you've done. One of the things I've noticed, though, is that there is a generational thing here, and you perhaps have noticed this too. I'll arbitrarily say people over the age of 40 are not really into the things that the people under the age of 40 in Twitter, Facebook and you name it, whatever else is out there, and there's plenty. How do you explain that?
Well, there is some truth to that. I think it is changing. I think people are getting more and more comfortable with using technology because the technology is treating them more like humans, and it's inviting them more. It's more intuitive. It's something that unfolds in a more graceful manner. I think, you know, when I was growing up, a lot of folks around me and a lot of adults, quote unquote, would shy away from technology because they assumed the technology was the smart thing, and therefore, you know, they just didn't have the skill or mindfulness to operate it. But that's changed. You know, the technology we see today is really putting everything that we have as humans first. You know, we've moved from using a keyboard and a mouse and manipulating an abstract concept on the screen to using our fingers and our voice. And I think you continue to see that. So, you know, I'm a firm believer that we're born with everything that we need, and technology is a reflective mirror upon that. And little by little, we go faster and faster into that realization, and we're using more of these things that we're already given when we're born. So I see that as a great enabler, and I think, you know, the over 40 crowd is definitely going that way. And it's really just an understanding of how to use it best. And a lot of people, for instance, see Twitter, and they immediately say, well, you know, I don't have anything interesting to tweet about. I don't want to tweet, so I can't use it. But a lot of the value that I think I see in Twitter and the world sees is that it actually breaks news. You know, it's really about reading. It's about, you know, seeing the world in an instant. It's about being the first to know that something happened that you care deeply about, whether it's locally around you, whether it's in your social network, or whether it's global. And it has this amazing dynamic range that shifts throughout the day and throughout our life. So it's just like seeing these things in a different light that allow you to get them in, to get into them in a different way. And I think people have to have their own approaches, and they have to have their own pacing towards it. But, you know, I think we all benefit from accessing this technology because it does bring us closer. It makes the world feel smaller.
Would you agree that the Arab Spring may be one of the best things that ever happened to your company?
No, I mean, I think that was, you know, monumental for us, but I think it was monumental for the world in that, you know, it enabled people to see immediately what was happening halfway around the world. And for me, you know, the moment I think of the most is during the Iranian protests of the election. You know, Iran was very much a black box to me, but suddenly I was seeing people on the street who were taking videos of what was happening on the street and talking and tweeting about what was happening on the street, you know, and what they felt about it, you know. And I'd never seen that before. I'd never been that close. And that was all in my pocket. I would take a device out from my pocket and I could see the world. And it's just so compelling to think about. But also I couldn't just see it. I could respond. I could reply and I could get into a conversation. So I think the more of that we see in the world, the more potential for empathy we have. And if you have more potential for empathy, you really have a chance at minimizing conflict. So I think these are generally good movements that do put lights on conversations that are happening right now, but now the world can see them and the world can participate and the world can learn from them.
In your wildest dreams, when you're getting going on this, did you anticipate or envision this kind of thing happening?
We knew the concept was going to be big, but we had no idea what the velocity would be or, you know, how people would use it, how people would make it a part of their daily life. So that's been the most impressive thing and the most inspiring thing is, you know, one day we have people who are just tweeting about their daily lives, and another day, you know, we break news. And just the way that people shift, not just on a weekly basis or a monthly basis, on a yearly basis, but tweet by tweet, you know, they're talking about, here's a beautiful sunset I just saw, and here's what I think about this crisis happening over here, and here's what I think about this Canada, and I just had an amazing coffee, and you see their world, and you see the world, and it really goes back to this very local experience, and then very social experience, and then very global experience, and they all tie together, and that's how I think the world should be viewed, because it is one big place, but it should be seen very small.
Let's tie that into the business discussion we're having. Katie, do you use Twitter in business?
Yeah, I do.
You're under 40.
Right. And I've I've used it more when there's something to be talking about, if I'm involved with an event like the Let's Talk, or, you know, maybe a fashion event in St. Louis. If there's something to be talking about that I can have a hashtag and see what other people are saying about it, is when I've enjoyed it the most. I'm not one to show everyone what kind of coffee I'm drinking unless it's from Sump, which I did yesterday. But I think it's been such a essential way to stay engaged with current customers. On Facebook, we have 1,900 people following us, and that baffles my mind that that many people have signed up to see what we have to say about our product. But it's been something that we completely rely on for keeping people engaged.
Scott Carey, how about you? Do you use it, and is it effective for your business?
I think so. We use it basically two tools to really communicate with people that come in the shop: Twitter and a blog, a Tumblr. So if we get a new coffee, a new roast, a new event, it gets tweeted. So that's the fastest way to tell people what we're doing in the shop. And I use it to see what other shops are doing, just so it's sort of full circle. Use it for inspiration for the shop. But I don't have a personal Twitter account, and I try and limit it strictly to coffee.
Jack, sign him up, will you? Before, you've had some of these discussions in San Francisco, you mentioned. Have you found, just as Katie and Scott have indicated, that this is becoming a more effective tool for businesses?
Yeah, I mean, we had one example. We were in a neighborhood in San Francisco, and there was a question asked by the audience about effective means of using social media. And the person was actually asking all the panelists. They weren't asking me at all. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a huge sign in terms of how people are using these technologies and really owning them. And they're driving the value of it, and they're communicating the value of it in real time. So, I think that's been fantastic to see. It's certainly around engagement, and certainly around inspiration. But it feels great to see, the people behind the coffee store that you go to every day, the mm-hmm. people behind the jewelry that you just purchased, because it adds a humanity. It adds a dimension of humanity that we don't often get to see. And I think that's where Twitter really shines, is that, we put a lot of these companies and these businesses and public figures up on a pedestal, which we feel they're out of reach. But this really reminds us that everyone is on the same plane. We all go through the same challenges in our daily life, and there are humans behind these things. There are humans behind these brands.
They used to say that word of mouth was the best advertising. This is the 21st century word of mouth.
Absolutely, and it's just faster, and more people can participate in it. So, someone halfway around the world in the middle of Kenya with a $5 cell phone can participate in the very same conversation that Scott does on his iPad today.
And right? he might show up at Sump one of these days, Scott. You never know. You never know.
I hope so.
Let's go back to Square for a moment, because our time is beginning to get away. This is obviously quite an innovation, utilizing the most modern technology. Is this a first big step toward a cashless society?
A lot of people talk about cashless society and what that means in the future of currency and the future of payments. I don't think it's a winner takes all. I think you have dramatic shifts, but cash will always exist. I think cards will always exist. I think checks will have a place in the world. And I think there is something there around digital and using phones to pay. We certainly have seen Square as a bridge. We are using plastic cards everywhere, not just credit cards, but debit cards and prepaid cards and gift cards. So why not enable everyone to accept them? Because we find that if you don't accept them, you actually lose out on a sale. And the cost of losing a sale, losing a customer that you can convert to someone who is loyal and keeps coming back, is immense. And it's hard. It's really hard to see immediately. It's more of a long-term picture. So if you can get that intent of purchasing right away, and if you can get that intent of wanting to buy into an experience with your attention and also with the money that you work so hard for, it should be fast and it should be easy. And that was the spirit of the company and starting the company, is let's do whatever it takes to take something that people are already carrying around in their pocket. They already know how to use. What's the simplest thing that we can do to plug into that and make it a superpower so that they can participate in this economy.
Only a couple of minutes left. In the conversations that you've had out on the West Coast, what do you think is the most important thing or things that you've learned so far from these discussions?
You know, really the ties between all these businesses. And I think the most important thing that's come out of every single conversation is really the concept. And, you know, we say this a lot, but actually doing it is the thing to keep in mind, is putting the customer first. And everything has to be designed around the customer and around building that beautiful experience that people walk into and they feel like, wow, like this is stunning. I want to keep coming back here. And I appreciate not just the product I'm getting, but also all the work, all the passion, all the love that went into it. I think that's where the trend is going, is like people want to see that. You know, this country was built on that concept, and people want those crafted experiences again. They want that local feeling. They want to be proud of their neighborhood. They want to be proud of those places that no matter how much of our life moves online, will never go away. I'm always going to be walking around the corner to my favorite coffee store to meet my friend.
Katie and Scott, that's exactly what you want to hear, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We have to end this part of the conversation right now. Jack, I know you have to leave. Thank you so much for being with us. And again, welcome home. And good luck at your meeting tonight. I know you've already achieved what you wanted from that, because it sold out, from what I understand.
Sold out. Thanks for having us.
At the Casa Loma Ballroom. Katie and Scott are going to stay with us, and we'll be back in just a moment. We'll bring in a representative from the Small Business Administration here locally and continue this conversation. But good luck to you. Continued success, Jack Dorsey. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Jack Dorsey has left us with a lot of food for thought, I think. We're joined now by Dennis Melton, District Director of the Small Business Administration for Eastern Missouri. But before we continue our conversation about small businesses and entrepreneurship, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Illinois Republicans are meeting today to vote on a new House leader. This afternoon, Senator Roy Blunt weighs in on fuel prices, and the Missouri Highway Patrol plans to crack down on driving offenses during this Labor Day holiday weekend. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the business at hand. Dennis, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for having me.
You had an opportunity to listen to Jack Dorsey. What do you think of the things he's saying and the ideas he has for a closer communication between business and community?
Well, I think he's dead on, and obviously his success exemplifies that he is dead on. I think one of the things I'd like to say about Jack and Jim McKelvey is that they are so important.
His partner, by the way, also a St. Louisan. Yeah.
They provide role models for the other entrepreneurs here in town. It really creates an atmosphere of if they can do it, a local person, a person just like me, I can do it. I can start a successful business as well. So they're so important to the community, especially in the area of entrepreneurship, which is what we of course are interested in at the SBA. So what we see they do is they create a can-do atmosphere. So getting back to what they have invented, Jack was on a program for the SBA in June, our National Small Business Week, and he was sitting on a panel similar to what he was doing today, and a gentleman on there was from New York who drove a truck, a food truck, that sold lobster rolls. And he said the two things that really make his business work were Twitter, where he can tweet where he's going to be. Based upon the old ice cream truck rules, people they can't pull over, those people are lined up for him. And then also Square, where he can actually make the transaction right there at his truck. And, of course, he was very complimentary to Jack sitting right across from him. He said, so without your inventions, I'm out of business. So I think what Jack and people like Jack have done have made it easier for our entrepreneurs to compete, to basically level that playing field with the big box stores, where suddenly, you know, you can broadcast out to potential clients and get them into your store, and then more importantly, start to sell them on who you are and what you do and what products and services you have to offer them.
Give us a capsulized version of what the SBA does and what it does here locally.
Sure. The SBA was founded in 1953 pretty much because President Eisenhower recognized the contribution small businesses made to World War II, particularly their innovations and flexibility. That's where much of our innovations come from in America and in the world for that matter, but we kind of lead the way in innovations, and we think entrepreneurship is why. So if we were founded in 1953. We have three primary missions. We have additional missions, but our three primary missions are to help small businesses get access to capital. We do that through a loan guarantee program. So we work with banks and non-bank lenders so that when small businesses go in to try to get a commercial loan, if they would be turned down normally, maybe they're lacking collateral, perhaps they're a startup without a tax return to show what their true returns are, they might look to an SBA, and then we guarantee the loan to the lender. And we'll guarantee anywhere from 50 to 90% of the loan depending upon the program. So access to capital is the first. We call it our three C's. The second one is counseling. We work with four organizations that the SBA gives a grant to so that they will provide no-cost counseling and low-cost training to entrepreneurs so they can learn some of the skills of entrepreneurship. What we often find in small businesses is someone has a very strong talent in a particular service or knowledge of a product, but they've never run a business. This is where a counselor can really come in handy and help them maybe avoid some of the minefields that are very common to small businesses. And then the third one is access to government contracts, and we work with our what we call socially and disadvantaged businesses to try to help them get access for non-compete government contracts.
Right. Katie, have you utilized the Small Business Administration?
I've utilized their website with links to different forms and stuff, but no, I haven't met with a counselor or anything, but I think that would be helpful for us and helpful for so many people who are just getting started.
Scott, how about you?
Nope. Well, I mean, what relationship do you have to the small business office in City Hall? Like, I've used some of their resources, but that's more navigating licenses and
that's
stuff.
That's more of a local,
yeah.
But we do partner. A lot of government agencies will partner with each other. For example, if someone's wanting to sell to the federal government, or state or local for that matter, we partner with an organization called the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, the PTAC. And they're very good at teaching you how to navigate that government contracting system, basically how to fish in our waters, because it's a little different than selling, in private domain. So we do partner in that regard. We are aware of the mayor's office. We partner with them on some training programs. But we've got to the point now where if you're good at something, you do it, and if you're not, you refer them to the office that is. But I would like to also say, too, that they don't just help startups. They will also help businesses that are in existence, looking to grow, which is sometimes a very difficult time for a small business. Growth can be dangerous if you're not ready for it or you're not capitalized to do it. It's also a matter of the organization's SCORE, which stands for Service Corps of Retired Executives. They'll actually do what they call a scan of your business. They'll bring in a team, just like a consulting group, and analyze your processes and procedures and make recommendations on how to improve it.
I have to take a break. We'll do that now, and I'll advise our audience that we're happy to take your calls. If you're thinking about starting a business or have one and maybe having some difficulty at the present time or having some great success, let us know about it at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll also take a tweet, of course, at STL On Air. My guests in studio are Scott Carey, owner of Some Coffee in St. Louis, Katie Miller, owner of Scarlet Garnet Jewelry. Dennis Melton is with us. He is the District Director of the Small Business Administration of Eastern Missouri. We'll be back to continue our discussion in a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about small business in the St. Louis area, how to get started and how to maintain the business once you have it. My guests in studio are Dennis Melton, a district director for the Small Business Administration of Eastern Missouri. Scott Carey is with us, owner of Some Coffee in St. Louis. Katie Miller, owner of Scarlet Garnet Jewelry. We asked before we went on the air for people to tweet us some of the small businesses that they enjoy in St. Louis. The list is too long to read, but let me assure you that people were busy on their machines today getting at us through Twitter. Fun and Sports and Leisure is one of them. Gus Pretzels is one of them. More farmers markets are some of the things that people are saying. So they're listening and they're tweeting about it. And again, this communication has changed so dramatically in the last just few years since Mr. Dorsey got started in, I think it was 2006. Let me ask each of you, Katie and Scott, about your getting started. What kinds of difficulties did you have, or did you find easy about starting your company, Katie?
We got started in 2006 when a mutual friend of myself and my business partner bought some e-commerce stores and thought that we would do so well that there needed to be two of us. So introduced Garnet and I together. And we started just building things, putting our products up on this website. And the accessibility of being able to make an e-commerce website, I mean, it's even better now than it was in 2006, but that was one of the easier things. You can build it, but people don't always come to it. And I think one of the hardest things has been figuring out what to delegate and where to put your resources. Like in developing a website, do you hire someone for $5,000 to make you a pretty e-commerce website, or do you, you know, learn the language yourself and try to figure it out yourself? So that's been really hard, but we've managed ways to, we trade with photographers. They're the experts in that. We rely on them to make make us beautiful pictures.
So you have no physical store per se. It's all done online.
In the past, we do have a storefront now. But you know, when we were first getting started, we had no physical store. We only sold at markets and at shows and craft fairs and on our website too. So you don't have to have a store, and that's something that's really changing. I think is you can have this huge bustling business and never have a storefront.
Scott, you do have to have a store. It's hard to drink coffee through the computer.
Yep.
Tell us about your start.
Well, we have a store, and you ask me what's particularly hard or difficult, and I'll say that it's all difficult. I say the thing that's not difficult is the passion and the drive to do what you want to do. I got my start probably more emotionally. I came back to St. Louis for personal reasons, and threw all my energy into converting this building and creating a coffee shop. So in a way, I've sort of had two battles, and sometimes I can't disentangle them. Sometimes I can't disentangle my experience with the city in terms of like getting my occupancy permit versus getting my business up and running. So I'll say that, you know, delegating resources when you are operating a business and it's one or two or three people, you're doing everything, and it just consumes everything you have. So it's all pretty difficult except for the reason why you decided to create the business.
Dennis Melton, I think that's one thing that a lot of people who consider going into business don't consider. It ain't easy.
It's not easy. Yeah. And I think the success rates or survival kind of bear that out. It's not an easy task. What Scott just said is dead on. I remember I had a gentleman who came out of corporate America tell me he knew he was an entrepreneur when he found out that his postage machine didn't replenish itself. That fell on him along with everything else, you know, in his business. So, no, it's not easy, especially at the early part, at the early stages where you're trying to do everything. Katie mentioned, do you learn how to make your own website or do you hire it out or can you barter for it? Mm-hmm. Very, very common in small businesses. That's why we strongly encourage networking to find out there are other people in that very same situation. And it does help to talk to people who are struggling with the same things that you are.
Scott, how long have you been in business?
Since December 1, 2011.
2011. So you're relatively new.
And 21 months.
And the early stages are a struggle, needless to say, as you've indicated. Mm-hmm. Katie, since 2006, I think you said. So you've
correct,
got
yeah.
You've got a little bit of momentum going. I'll ask each of you, is St. Louis a good place to start a business? Katie?
Well, I actually...
Is it an easy place to start a business?
As far as having a storefront, we had already built up our brand and built up that awareness before we made a storefront. So, you know, to lock it in on St. Louis, I'm so surprised, not surprised, but it's been so great, the support that we get from people who keep coming back to us, and people really want to see us succeed. They are always so encouraging. And in that way, I think St. Louis is a great place to start a business. Speaking to things with the city, it is difficult. I think you have to have a carrier pigeon to take some of your paperwork into the city to get things done. And that is a really frustrating part of it that keeps you from just being able to really explode sometimes.
Where are you located?
On Cherokee Street.
Cherokee, great spot, right?
Yeah, thanks.
And you're on Jefferson, is that right?
A few blocks south from Cherokee Street.
Your thoughts on St. Louis as a place, an easy place or not so easy to do business?
Well, I can only be comparative because I was outside of St. Louis for about 20 years. So I came back directly from New York City. I feel like there's a lot of choice to do stuff in New York City, but there's more freedom to be creative in St. Louis. And if you throw a rock in the pond in St. Louis, you can actually see ripples. If you throw a rock in the pond in New York City, you're throwing it in the ocean and you see very little. So I do think that there's opportunity to be creative here. It's a question of, does it have the density to support that product or that creative venture? And but I will say the people that do support us and the people that I do see in the sort of South City, sort of Cherokee area are amazing people, like intelligent, loyal, curious, supportive, friendly. You know, we had a terrible thing happen early in our business where our sewer lateral collapsed. We had people coming by, offering to buy coffee, offering to dig that up, offering so many things. I don't think that would happen somewhere else. I don't think it would happen anywhere else that I've been. So I do think it's there. It's just a question of density and the willingness to support some of those creative endeavors.
Dennis, what's your take on this as a place to do business? What kind of feedback do you get from the folks that you are associated with?
Yeah, I would say it's getting much better than it has in the past. And part of that is because St. Louis for years recognized itself or identified itself as a big city town. We lost a lot of those big businesses over the last 20 years. So there's been a refocus on entrepreneurship. And it's been a joint effort of both the city and the county. And they're making it easier, or they're trying to make it easier, with regional clusters such as bioscience to create these little, and financial as well, these little enclaves, if you will, of self-support, of assistance from those with experience. They're also trying to bring capital to the scene now, too, which is part of the role that SBA has played traditionally. Capital is often one of the first and most difficult steps in starting a business, and you've got to have sufficient capital to get through the startup phase as well as economic downturns, which we just came through. So I wouldn't say it's an easy place, but I'd say it's one of the better places. We're getting a lot of national press coverage of the entrepreneurship spirit in this town, and it's starting to attract attention coast to coast.
Well, how important are small businesses to the big picture?
Oh, wow. About 50% of our gross domestic product, 44% of all employees. You know, they do 33%, and it's growing, percent of our exports. They generate, on average, about 16 times more patents per employee than a large corporation. Extremely important. You know, it's what has built America, and you know, if I can use my own agency, the SBA, as an example, we probably got our best compliment in the year 2000 when Great Britain shadowed us for 18 months and started the Small Business Service in Great Britain. The rest of the world is taking notice of the entrepreneurship spirit in America, and they're trying to grow it themselves in their own countries. So extremely important. As a demographic, it's powerful.
As someone indicated earlier, perhaps it was you, we're really going back to the way it all started.
Well, you're right. I mean, all large businesses started small. You know, it's very rare that they don't. So, you know, St. Louis has been very good at starting or at entrepreneurs starting businesses and growing them to large businesses. We'd like to see a return to that. And the way you do it is to create an entrepreneurial ecosystem where you can offer support to those that are trying to make their businesses work, to grow them, whether it be a Main Street type business that makes your community more comfortable and more enjoyable to live in, or somebody who's trying to conquer the world with a global product.
Does it take a special type to be an entrepreneur?
I think not.
I disagree.
I don't think entrepreneurs are born. I really don't. I think it's something that the one common theme that I see in all entrepreneurs is passion. I had a boss once had a quote, I really like it. He said, you know, we never know which frog is going to turn into the prince, so we kiss them all. I think there's a lot of truth to that, you know. You never know which business is going to become the successful business. But the ones that do, they seem to all have passion in their founder.
You know, that's a word that I've noticed in some of the things I've read about Jack Dorsey. That's a term that he uses a lot, is the need for passion. Yeah. Katie, you laughed, and I wasn't going for laughs when I asked that question, but do you think it takes a special type?
I think it takes someone with a high tolerance for being uncomfortable at times, so either financially uncomfortable or being able to work on no sleep, and that's something that scares people off as they're getting started. With feeling that pinch in whatever way that they back out of it and then end up not succeeding.
Well, I'd agree with that. We're talking risk takers here.
Sure, absolutely. How about you, Scott?
Yeah, I think you have to be part stupid, a little delusional. You have to be willing to be reaching for stuff that you know are immediately out of your grasp. So there has to be a degree of uncertainty and kind of craziness. But I do agree that passion drives you through the lows. Mm-hmm. So you need to have that because you don't have a lot of highs, or you don't always have highs. Yeah.
Let's take a couple of calls. We have some folks who want to get in on this. Jaime is calling from St. Louis. I hope I have it pronounced correctly. Is it Jaime? Hello.
You mean Jamie?
Jamie, okay. The way it's it's spelled here, it looks like it's Jaime.
Question. My tongue's a little bit in my cheek. I think what you're doing for business is great. But doesn't something like Twitter kind of appeal to the most narcissistic instincts in us, kind of like talk radio, that everybody thinks they have something important to say and they can say it anytime they want?
Well, I wish you hadn't brought talk radio into that part of the conversation, but let's see.
I'm having fun.
Then good for you. We all should have more fun. Scott, you shook your head when you heard that.
Yeah, I would disagree. I mean, just briefly, we use Twitter not to say how great we are, but to let our customer base know what we have in the shop. You know, we get seasonal crops in, just like you get seasonal vegetables. We announce that. So it's not being narcissistic. I guess ultimately if we succeed, maybe it's selfish, but we're sharing that with the people that are enjoying what we're doing.
Let's bring in Tom calling from South City. Tom, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thanks. I was wondering, it seems like one of the ways to get early support for a new business is to be involved with new ideas and to build excitement and support in a community. And I was wondering if the SBA has any support for, say, cooperative businesses, how to get started, the legal framework for that sort of business. It seems like when you have a team starting, then you get a team of supporters out there in the community.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I think there's a certain amount of extent there is correct. If you look at a lot of the competitions, say, in the St. Louis area, they usually are geared somewhat more towards high tech or bioscience. By the same token, there is assistance for all businesses. Now, I do like to say we don't give grants at the SBA. We do loans. So there's a big difference that adds to your balance sheet. But no, when we talk about mentors and assistants, and I mentioned before we do counseling. We do it through the four organizations. I mentioned SCORE earlier, Service Corps of Retired Executives. We also work with the State of Missouri Small Business and Technology Development Center. We also work with the Women's Business Center and with the Veterans Business Resource Center. All of those offer both mentors and counselors to small businesses of any type. So there is assistance in that regard. And we like to encourage them to make an appointment and come in and talk to a counselor before they start investing money.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to try to bring Tara into the conversation, but we have a minute left. Tara, make it short and sweet, please.
Hi, thanks for having me on the air. I love the businesses that you're featuring, and I just wanted to make a comment that I think St. Louis is a great place for entrepreneurship because there are very few barriers to entry. And as Scott said, you can experiment a lot more than in some of the other cities. And I think that locally we're not promoting actually the diversity of entrepreneurship we have here, just speaking sort of industry agnostic. I think there are lots of types of businesses that can do well here, and it doesn't just have to be tech startups. It doesn't just have to be coffee shop.
I've got to stop you there, Tara, because time is getting away. Good points. I wish we had more time to discuss them. But, yes, I'm sure everybody here at the table is glad to hear what Tara has to say. Mm-hmm. Got to end it there, folks. Thank you so much, Dennis Melton, for being with us from the Small Business Administration. Katie Miller, thank you so much. Continued success with your operation. Your website is what?
Is scarletgarnet.com. Scarlet with two T's, Garnet with one.
Okay. And Scott, same to you. Scott Carey.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with Mo Rocca about juggling his roles as CBS Monday Morning correspondent, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, and host of My Grandmother's Ravioli on the Cooking Channel, of course. He'll also talk with Ben Hilliker about his children's book based on the history of a 1926 Willys Overland automobile. And then we'll take a look at a mural project at Craft Alliance asking participants to complete the phrase, "Before I die, I want to..." You can fill in the blank. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll have a holiday rebroadcast of my conversation with Arthur Herman about his book dealing with the role of American business in the U.S. victory in World War II. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.